Okay, now that the beamer is finally working, good morning everyone. Welcome to the Monday morning lecture on diagnostics, medical image processing. Professor Honegger can't be here today, so he asked me to give the lecture today. I'm Marco Bögl. I'm also one of the guys doing the exercises. So you'll probably see me in the next coming weeks. So what we're talking today about is X-ray specific image processing, pre-processing, using image intensifiers. So the contents of the lecture, we will start off with some basics about X-rays and X-ray detectors. And then we will talk about the specific problem of image distortion or image distortion correction. So that's our goal, to correct it. And after that, maybe some remarks and more specific problems in the approach to deal with image distortion. So what does an X-ray system consist of? Basically, we have an X-ray source. And we have a detector somewhere. And in between, we can put an object. And the X-rays will penetrate the object and attenuate depending on the material. And the detector can then measure the energies of the X-ray particles. So first off, in X-ray image acquisition, there are different types of image artifacts. Some are caused by the X-ray sources. Some are caused by the X-ray detectors. And what we are considering today are artifacts that are caused by the image detectors, in specific by the image intensifiers. So the image intensifiers are one of the older techniques, which were introduced in 1940 roundabout. And nowadays, they are still used in some hospitals and older systems. But if you were to buy a new system by Siemens or by Philips, you won't be able to get a new system with an image intensifier anymore. So they're pretty outdated. And nowadays, all new systems are using flat panel detectors, which were introduced about 15 years ago. And yeah, we're mainly using in research the flat panel detectors. And as I said, the new equipment only comes with flat panel detectors anymore. So image intensifiers are outdated. And yeah, we're still covering the artifacts, but it's mostly for historical reasons here. So how does an X-ray tube work? So basically, we have the cathode to the right here. And it is heated up. And as it is heated up, electrons are released. The electrons are released in this electric field here and are accelerated. And when they hit the anode, there are the X-ray particles that are released. And they're released in these in the directions of the arrows here. And now you can put an object in between and maybe put a film sheet behind it. And then you get the classical X-rays on film sheets, as you've maybe seen in TV shows, or maybe you had an X-ray yourself. But with newer technology, with detectors, you can also capture it with a CCD chip and display it on your computer screen. One of the problems with these X-ray tubes is that they are very inefficient. So of that energy that is produced here, 99% will be released as heat. So we have a pretty bad cooling problem here. And that is something that was only dealt with recently in about 2005. And there's also a slide later on about that. So there's one of the phenomena that will cause image artifacts. This is the Hill effect here. And basically, what you can see here is you have the electrons that are released here. They hit the anode. And the problem is, depending on the direction that the X-ray particles are released, they have a different energy. So if you consider the central ray here as the 100%, then you will have X-ray particles that are released in the direction of the cathode. They will have higher energy. And the inverse is true for X-ray particles that are released away from the cathode. They have even lower energy. So if you look at an image then, of an object that has that consists of one material, you would expect for the whole object the same intensity, right? But instead, you will see so from dark to bright, from left to right, because the lower energies result in darker intensities. That's a problem of inhomogeneities of the intensities, and I think this will be covered in one or two lectures. So not today. So as I mentioned, the cooling problem was solved in about 2005 by engineers from Erlangen. They developed this new X-ray tube called the Straton tube. And what they did here is they embedded the X-ray tube in an oil field here. And the anode is also rotating. So the problem why we're rotating the anode is if the electrons always hit the same spot on the anode, we have the heating problem, and if they always hit the same spot, so they rotated the impact of the electrons is spread more evenly above the whole anode, and it's also cooled down while it's rotating, so we have less of a material deterioration here. The engineers were also nominated for the German Zukunftspreis in 2005, so you see it's a really high impact invention here, and it's also highly used now. So you can see here two X-ray tubes. On the left side, a traditional X-ray tube, which was used in the years before the Straton tube was invented. It still had the problem of the static anode and the heating problem. And with the Straton tube here, the Straton tube by Siemens, you can see it's larger, and you have the anode here that is rotating, and the cathode. Yeah, so these are just some basics in order to understand why we need our image preprocessing methods. So for us, it's only important to know how the X-ray systems work in general. We don't have to know any specific details about electron acceleration and stuff like that. So we're not optics guys. So here are the mentioned image detectors. On the left side, you can see the image intensifier. As I said, it's the older technology. It's really quite large. So, and you can also recognize it easily. It's this round tube. It's a round vacuum tube. And if you're ever in the hospital and you see a system with these round image intensifiers, you know it's probably one of the older systems, and they haven't upgraded to a newer system yet. But it still works, just not as good as the new flat panel detectors. So the flat panel detectors, the flat panel is this colored part here. The rest is just part of the, where it is placed on the system. So the important part of the detector is this one here. These are some other images of a system, how it would look like in an operating room. So to the left again, the image intensifier. So these are C-arm systems. And the C-arm is basically just a robotic C-arm. And on one end, you can place the detector, like here. And on the other hand, you place the source. And the nice thing about the C-arm is you can rotate it. So it's a robotic system. And so you can basically acquire X-rays from every angle you desire. Not every angle, because the table and the patient are in the way sometimes. But there's many angles possible. And also, if you acquire X-rays from different angles, you can also use image reconstruction. So you can get a CT reconstruction, computer tomography, with the C-arm system. So usually the CT systems, as you know them, they are these round tubes, which you get slided through. But the C-arm CT can also be used in the interventional suite. So it's a really high impact invention, and it's highly used in cardiology, for example, and also in imaging of the brain for digital subtraction angiographies and stuff like that. Yeah, on the right side, you can see a neural system. Just a marketing photo. And here's the flat panel, if you can see it. And here's the screen to visualize the reconstructions and the X-rays images. Okay, so as I said, we're dealing with the image intensifier today. The flat panel detector has also some problems, but they will be covered in later lectures. And today we will try to find out what the problem in image intensifiers is. And how does an image intensifier work? So again, we have our X-ray particles. And the first layer on the image intensifier is a phosphor layer. And the phosphor layer converts the X-ray particles to visible light. So what wavelengths does visible light have? Does anybody know? Yeah. So about 400 to 800 nanometers. And the visible light then hits a photocathode, where the light is converted into electrons. And now these electrons can be accelerated by electron optics. And we finally have an output layer where they are converted back to light. So after that, you can just place a CCD chip. You can measure the light, and then you can transfer it onto your computer screen and look at it. So again, here's the structure of an image intensifier. Again, you have the X-rays here. Then here's the input window with the phosphor screen. It's converted to light. Here it's converted to electrons. Then you have the electron optics that speed up the electrons here. And this whole thing here is a vacuum tube. And then you have the luminescent screen, and it's converted back to light. And then you can place the CCD chip behind it. And so what could be the problem here if you have electrons in a vacuum tube? How could you manipulate the electrons so you could so you get a worse image? So what happens if I place a magnet close to the image intensifier? Does anybody have an idea? Yeah, basically, the electrons are just diverted, and they won't represent the geometry anymore. So we will get a distorted image. We get higher noise. And basically, the distortion is the problem. So obviously, no one is walking around with magnets in his pockets while he's getting an X-ray scan. But the problem is there's also this nice thing called the Earth magnetic field. And even the Earth magnetic field will cause these distortion problems. And that's basically the reason why we need to undistort our images. So this is some more physics stuff. Just some material. They're using cesium iodide because it preserves the spatial resolution, because it's these pin-like structures here. Yeah, it's not really that important. Some more material stuff for the image intensifier. So the luminescent screen is the cesium iodide, the photocathode, and the output luminescent screen. And now back to the real problem, the image distortion, and how to correct the image distortion. So as I mentioned, the problem with the image intensifiers is with electrons and that are traveling in a vacuum tube. And if you have an Earth magnetic field, the electrons won't travel straight. They will be distorted a little bit, and you might end up with a distorted image. What's also a problem is artificial magnetic fields. So what happens if there's an MR scanner in the room next door or below? So every time you turn the MR scanner on, all the electrons might get sucked to the ground if you have an MR scanner below. So usually that's not the case in hospitals. Nowadays, they know about these problems. There's also scattering and the convex entrance screen, which is causing artifacts. But for now, we're dealing with the magnetic field caused artifacts, the image distortion. Sorry. So how could we visualize this image distortion? What if we place a rectangular grid, like on the right here, directly on the image detector? If we now take an X-ray image of this grid, you will get an image like that. So straight lines of the real object will be mapped onto these curved lines. While in reality, we would expect straight lines map onto straight lines. So that would be the ideal image. We would want to get an image like that. Instead, because of the magnetic fields, we get an image like that. And yeah, basically, if you're an experienced radiologist, you might be able to deal with these images. You just have enough experience, you know what your object looks like, you know what to expect, and you can just remove these distortion effects in your head. But what if you want to use these images to do a 3D reconstruction, for example? So if you want to work with them on the computer screen, you can't use these curved images then. You have to undistort them, and you have to use the ideal image, the undistorted image, for 3D reconstruction. So that's one of the reasons why we have to do undistortion. Usually radiologists might just say, oh, it's not important, I can deal with that. But if you want to work further with these images, you have to pre-process them and get rid of the artifacts. So here's the definition for image undistortion. So basically what we want to do is we want to undistort the image, so we want to find a mapping that gets rid of the distortion. So we want to map the undistorted image back onto the ideal image. So it's an image-to-image mapping that eliminates the distortions. There's another kind of image distortion. So what I've explained before is the geometric distortion. So in reality, we assume that straight lines would map onto straight lines. But with distortion, we will end up with curved lines instead. And there's also the intensity distortion here, which basically causes that one tissue class doesn't map onto the same intensity. So you would expect that water always has the same intensity in the whole scan, right? And in intensity distortion, it might happen that one tissue class, for example, water, is represented by different intensities in the image. So you want to get rid of that too. So that's the problem of intensity homogenization, which is also caused by the Hill effect, for example. And I think this will be covered in two lectures from now, I think. Okay, so here's an example of an image grid. You have on the left side the ideal image, and on the right side a distorted image. So what are some problems you see right from this picture that we have to deal with in our algorithm later? So the first thing is that we have a point on the grid here, and it is mapped on a point between grid points here. So how can we deal with that? What is the intensity value for this point in between here? What do we have to do? Does anybody know? Does anyone have heard lectures on computer graphics or any computer scientists here? Do you know? Yes. Right. So we have to do an interpolation. So what is interpolation? Let's just look at an example. So we have four grid points. And let's say this grid point has the intensity 10, 15, 20, and 25. So now I have a point that is located here. So in the easiest case, with the easiest kind of interpolation, what could I do? What intensity value would I assign to this pixel here? Ideas? Yes. So the easiest interpolation you could do is the nearest neighbor interpolation. And basically what you do is you look which point of the neighboring points is the closest. So you measure the Euclidean distance, and as you can see, the point with the intensity value 10 here is the closest, so you would assign the value 10. And the other points don't matter for this kind of interpolation. Just the nearest point, you assign the value. As I said, it's the simplest variation of the interpolation, and it's not the best one. So the images you would get if you use a nearest neighbor interpolation for the whole image would look rather noisy, and it's not ideal. So instead, you could do a bilinear interpolation. So what you want to do is you want to take all the four neighboring points into account for this intensity value. So what you can do is you can do a weighted average of all the intensity values. And the weights are based on the distance, or in the bilinear case, on the on the areas here of the neighboring points. So maybe just let's first look at a linear interpolation in the 1D case. So if you just have 2 points, 10 and 15, and I have a point in between here. So how could I weight the point in between here with the neighboring intensity values? So we have the distance here and the distance here. So let's call this A, and this is 1 minus A. And the intensity value for this point x here would be A times 15 plus 1 minus A times 10. So you always weight with the inverse distance to the point, so always the opposite directions. Because if the point is closer to one specific pixel, you want to assign it a higher weight. So if we assume this is 3/4 and 1/4, it would be 3/4 times 10 plus 1/4 times 15. And it would be 11 point something. Okay. So how can we use this knowledge for the bilinear interpolation? Bilinear interpolation, if you look at this image closely, maybe if I draw some lines here, bilinear interpolation can also be represented by several steps of linear interpolation. So as I did already here, I can first interpolate this point here linearly between 10 and 15. And then I can do another interpolation in the row below. So I can interpolate this point, let's call this one x and this one y. And finally, I can do a third interpolation along these between these two interpolated points. So then I will get this point. And if you write the three equations down, you will see that it's not weighted by the distance between the points, but by the areas that are spanned in these rectangles here. So this point intensity value will be weighted with this area, this one with this here. This will be weighted by this large area here. And finally, this one will be weighted by this small area here. So if you plug them all in, you will see something like 25 times this distance times this distance, and so forth. OK, so this is bilinear interpolation. Is that clearer? Does anyone have any questions about it? Feel free to ask. You have enough time. From where? From the start?
How do you keep the steps of the interpolation?
Of the bilinear interpolation?
Yeah.
Okay, so you can do a linear interpolation in the first row, right? Then you get this point here. In the end, you want to get the value for this point, right? So now if you draw these lines here, you can see there's an intersection on this row for this point x here, OK? Then you interpolate the value for this intersection point. Then you can do the same for the row below. And then you get this point here, which I called y. And now you have these two interpolated points. And the point you finally want to get is in between those two points. So you do a linear interpolation in the y direction here to get this point. So x is, let's just do it with, let's call this a and 1 minus a. This is the same down here. And let's do this b and 1 minus b. So x is, maybe I should assign some variable names instead of 10 and 15 here. So x is a times. Let's call this R, S, T, and U. A times S plus 1 minus A times R. Okay, then Y is also A times U plus 1 minus A times T. And then in the final step, let's call this value set. In the final step, you interpolate x, no, let's start with y, b times y plus 1 minus b times x. Okay? And if you plug the x and the y in, you will see if you plug the y in, you get directly at the start b times a times u, so b times a times u, the opposite areas of the rectangles. Yeah?
I think this is clear since you have like it's kind of a rectangle, but what if the points you have are not aligned in a rectangle or something?
We're dealing with images, so they're always aligned. So the images are always an equidistant grid. So the pixels always have a constant offset between them. There will always be a quadratic set of neighboring points.
Sometimes you don't have the points to, just like this little point you're trying to interpolate to find a value. Like sometimes you don't have all the points as well.
You mean if I have a pixel on the border of the image that I don't have for imaging?
For example, if you don't have the point S, let's say you also don't have that point.
Yeah, but that doesn't happen in images. So the image is always, the pixels in the x directions are always of a constant offset. So they're always in the same, two rows will always have the same offset between the pixels. So images with unevenly placed pixels usually we don't have to deal with. Okay, any other questions about interpolation? Okay, so then let's talk about what Professor Honinger calls the rule of thumb. A very important rule is to always sample in the output space. So in this case, we have the ideal image and the distorted image. So what is our output space here? What is the output of our algorithm? Yeah. So we want to end up with the ideal image. You want to undistort the image. So in order to understand why we have to sample in the output space, maybe let's just look at what happens if we don't do it. So let's look at an image and another image. Okay, let's say this is the ideal image, and this is the distorted image. Okay, what happens if I sample in the distorted image? So I take a pixel in the distorted image, and I map it back onto the ideal image. I take the next pixel, I map it back. Maybe it should map closer over there. I take the next pixel, and I map it over there. So what can happen if I map in this direction? It might happen that I don't hit all the pixels in the ideal image. That's the first problem, because you don't know how the distortion actually works. So maybe if I map them all, I will end up with a blank area somewhere in between here, because the pixels down here, they all map below here, and they also map below here. And you would have to interpolate these values, and that's not ideal. And also another problem is we can't interpolate here. If we hit a value in between here, we would have to extrapolate it. So we would have to spread the intensity to all the four neighboring pixels. And that's also not something you want to do to get a nice image. Okay, so This is a big no, so we don't do that. Instead, what we want to do is we want to map the ideal image. We want to sample the ideal image. So we can just take every pixel in the ideal image, sample it, map it onto the distorted image, get a value, an intensity value. We can interpolate it in between here and put it into the pixel in the ideal image. And we can do that just for every pixel. And it works nicely. OK? So always sampling the output space. It's very important. And it's true for almost every application that you can think of. So what if you want to project a 3D object on a 2D plane? What would be the output space here? You would sample the 2D plane. Because you want to get the 2D image, the projection image, you sample the 2D projection image. Okay, so here are some more problems for the undistortions. The first one, we have to decide how we do the mapping. So we can do a parametric mapping. We can design a model function that does the mapping for us, for example, a polynomial. Or we can do a non-parametric mapping, which would just be a lookup table or a displacement vector field. And yeah, the interpolation I already talked about. So it can happen that pixels are mapped in between the pixels in the distorted image. And we have to decide how to estimate the parameters for the mapping then. So it has to be robust and reliable. Yeah, in our case, what does that mean? What is the answer to every question, as Professor Honegger says? Yeah. OK, so we just use SVD, and we're fine. Finally, we have to develop efficient algorithms and robust algorithms. So for example, in cardiology here, we need a real-time image undistortion. So it has to be able to be evaluated at 3 frames per second. So in order to do that, we might have to implement it on hardware, GPUs, or multi-threaded CPUs. OK, so in order to get our algorithm, we basically have a three-step process now. So the first is the model design. So as I said, we have to design our mapping function first. We have to decide if it's parametric, non-parametric. If it's parametric, what kind of polynomial, how many degrees. And then we have to estimate the model parameters. So we have to get the one specific mapping function that works for the system. And then finally, we have to do the inference. So we have to apply it to the data. OK, as I already said, the rule of thumb, always sample in the output space. Then, yeah, parametric versus non-parametric. In this case, we will use parametric parametric model here. Okay, the dimension of the parameter space should be selected carefully. Okay, that means let's just look at another example. So let's say I give you a set of points. Here. Okay, and now I ask you to find a model that represents this the set of points. What could you fit into this data? It's very simple. So this is an outlier, maybe. So don't look at it. So what could you? What kind of function could I fit to this data? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, let's just start with a line because it works rather well here. So I could fit a line through here. So it doesn't hit all the points, maybe even none, but it's a good parameterization for this kind of data. So it's typically called a linear regression here. So So we're doing a linear regression to this data. Okay, but now someone could say, okay, it's a pretty good fit, but I can do better. I can hit every point, but then I couldn't do it with a line. So maybe he would have to fit a function like this, okay? So he might be able to hit every point. So this would be called an interpolation. If you hit every point exactly of your training data, you would interpolate these points. And now if you, let's look at this point, okay? So you get a good result for this function exactly at the point. But what happens if we slightly vary the input? So we say, let's say I evaluate the function at this point plus a small distance. So we would end up already down here. So a small variance of the input gives you a large difference in the output. And that's generally not something you would want if you want to fit a model to your input space, okay? So this data is overfitted. So you chose too many parameters for your model. That would be good. So basically you want to get a model that generalizes the data well. So you have all these points here and you would expect, in this case, a linear relationship between them. So if you slightly vary them, the input doesn't change that much from plus to minus even here, okay? So this is interpolation if you fit every point, and in this case even overfitting because I do some unnecessary oscillations here. But the takeaway here is we don't want to choose too many parameters for our model, okay? So it always has to be chosen carefully, and maybe you have to try different kinds of models to decide which one is the best. Okay, so linear versus nonlinear estimators already said we're just using SVD because that's just the solution to almost everything. And in order to get our real-time undistortion that we need for example, for the cardiology, we have to use our hardware optimally. So multi-core CPUs, graphics cards. The nice thing about GPUs is that interpolation is done implicitly there. Okay, you can load an image as a texture, and the hardware will just do the interpolation very fast. It's hardware accelerated, so you can just choose any kind of pixel that you want. You don't have to hit a grid point, and the hardware will do the interpolation for you. So you don't have to think about bilinear interpolation at all. Yeah, the cell processor from the PS3. So basically, graphics cards are very important development tool in medical imaging. So many applications are implemented on the hardware. Okay, so now to the model. So as I said, the non-parametric mapping it would be a lookup table or displacement vector field. So you would just have a table that tells you pixel xy is always mapped to pixel x plus something and y plus something, okay? So just a table where you look into what the displacement is. But what we want to get a parametric function that maps each pixel of the undistorted image to the distorted image. So these are just some basic definitions that we will need in the next slides. So important to know is the undistorted image here is x prime, y prime, the pixels, and the distorted image is x and y. And then we have some coefficients for our parametric model, which are u and v here. And we basically, what we want is we want to get a bivariate function here. Bivariate means you just have two input parameters, x and y, or x prime, y prime. And we have this polynomial here with the basis functions. And this polynomial should map the undistorted image back onto the distorted image. Okay. So let's just look at an example. So we want to look at polynomials. So we choose for the basis functions, we choose x to the power of I. Okay, and then we get the following function here. It's filled up by a variate polynomial, and that's the function for the x coordinates. So maybe let's just look at a polynomial of degree 2. How would that look like? We would get for a mapping of x is, okay. Okay, I will not use the u with two indices. I would just go with one index for simplicity so I don't confuse myself, okay? So I would just go with u0 plus u1 times x plus u2 times y. Then we have the u3 times x to the power of 2 plus u4 y to the power of 2. And finally, we have u5 times xy. Okay, we need the primes everywhere. Okay. So that would be the function for the x mapping if we chose to only use a polynomial of degree 2. Okay, so the problem now is how do we get our point correspondences? So in order to estimate the u parameters here, we need to know some training points, right? We need to know some training points where they are placed on the ideal image and where they end up in the distorted image. And how we can do that is we have a calibration pattern, like this here, for example. It's just a highly accurate manufactured grid. And in this case, you can use squares, dots, or circles. So the nice thing about circles is you can easily compute the center of the circle. So it's pretty accurate. And you just place this calibration pattern onto your detector. And then you take an x-ray. And then you will get an x-ray image that is distorted of this calibration pattern. So basically, then you have the ideal image coordinates of the calibration pattern because you manufactured it, you know where the points are. And you have the distorted image, and you just have to compute the centers for the distorted image, and then you have point correspondences. So you have a set of n points that are on a calibration pattern, which are the ideal points. So these are the xy primes. And you have a set of observed points, which are the points of this calibration pattern, how they are mapped in the distorted image. So this is a set of endpoints of x and y coordinates. And now the problem is we want to estimate the parameters, the u and the v's of our model. Okay, so what we're doing is we're using a least square estimation. So least square estimation is basically we want to find the parameters of the mapping that if we map the points, they have the minimal distance to the original points. So basically the sum of square distances of the mapped points to the original points. The original points in this case are the distorted image because our mapping maps from the ideal, the output space, to the distorted image. So the map points minus the ideal distorted points to the power of 2, and we minimize that. So we have two separate minimization problems for the x mapping and for the y mapping. Okay. So basically, now we have n equations. We can set up n equations because we have n points of correspondence. And we can set up n equations for x and n equations for y. And what we can do is we can rewrite these equations in matrix form. So we have our parameter vector u, u0 to okay, and now you can set up a measurement matrix, which would be 1 times u0, so 1, plus x prime. So this would be the x prime 0 plus y prime 0 plus x prime. OK, not enough space here. And x, y. And we have n lines of that, so n different equations. And we just have to plug in the observed points from our calibration pattern here. And of course, we get the x vector here. OK, so we can use our observed points. We have the n pixels in the distorted image. We can plug in the coordinates of the calibration pattern. And then the unknowns are only the u's, which we want to solve for. So yeah, so this is our matrix A in the slides. And that's also called the measurement matrix, because we plug in the measurements. OK, so these are some exercise problems. I think they will be covered in the exercise. So then you can compute the components of A if you know some point correspondences. So we can't do it here. So maybe if you, I don't know if the exercise is already online. But if it is, you can already have a look at it in MATLAB and just implement it. It's not that many lines of code. OK. OK, so how can we do the estimation of the parameters now? So obviously, this is not a quadratic matrix, so we can't just invert it. But as you've already learned, the SVT is a pretty powerful tool, so we can do the pseudo-inverse. So you compute the SVT, and then you can compute the pseudo-inverse by transposing the submatrices. So basically, the problem ends up, you can just solve it by multiplying the pseudo-inverse of the measurement matrix A with the observed point coordinates x. So it's just a matrix vector multiplication in the end. Nothing complicated to solve. OK, so that's basically how you get your parameters here. So it's not that complicated. You just have to have a calibration pattern and then just use the SVD as you've learned it. OK, there's some more remarks about parametrization. So what you can see here is, again, these are some sample points, and someone did a linear regression here. And now if you use the standard definition for for a line, as you've maybe learned it in school, it is y is m times x plus t, right? But if you have a line that is parallel or almost parallel to the y-axis, the slope will be infinite, or close to infinite, if it's not exactly parallel. So you have a singularity here. You can't solve it, so it's an ill-posed problem. And again, you have the problem here, if you vary the input slightly, you will get a much different result. If you choose a slightly higher x value here, you get a much lower value for y, in the case of not exactly infinite. So it's very ill-posed. It's not a fair parametrization. But what you can do is, you can do the same set of points. But what you do is, you can rotate the coordinate system. So now, all of a sudden, your parametrization is no longer a problem. So you don't have an infinite number for m. You have a normal slope. And It's also no longer ill-posed, because if you vary the x input slightly from here to here, you won't get a much different output for y. So it's always important to know if your problem is ill-posed or you just chose the wrong parametrization. Okay, so an ill-posed problem, for example, that you can't just rotate your coordinate system or choose a different parametrization, that will always be ill-posed, is, for example, okay, if you have an optical system, okay? So you have an image plane here. And you have a point here. So if you map this point on the image plane, it will end up here. Now, if you slightly vary the input, which is the angle in this case, so if you get a slightly larger alpha, you will get a much larger error from the original pixel in the image plane. So no matter how you change your parametrization here, the problem will always be ill-posed. A slight variation in the input will always result in a larger variation in the output. But if you're just dealing with a linear regression of some data points, you can just rotate your reference frame, and then it's no longer ill-posed. So you have to take care to choose a fair parametrization. So basically, instead of using y is mx plus t, you can use the fair parametrization, which is here, x times sine of alpha plus y times cosine of alpha is d. So you can just parameterize it by ax plus b y is d, or in vector form it is nt. Okay, so basically what's important to know here is that not every parametrization that you can choose is ideal. Some might have singularities, like the singularity for M here, if you have a parallel line to the y-axis. So the conclusion here, to always choose a parametrization that is independent from orthogonal transforms. So independent from orthogonal transforms means that you can't just rotate your coordinate system like I did in the slide earlier and get a fair parametrization. So you have to choose the fair parametrization from the start. Okay, so this is again interpolation. Interpolation, as I mentioned earlier, is when you fit a curve to your data and it hits every data point. So the curve hits every training data, and compared to that is the regression, or the linear regression if you fit a line, where we don't have to hit every data point, we just want to minimize the distance of the curve to all the data points. So it's basically also a linear, a least square estimation. So in literature, sometimes there's not that much of a differentiation between regression and interpolation. But Professor Honegger likes to differentiate between these two. So regression, not every point is hit. Interpolation, every point of the data is hit. And overfitting is, again, if you do an interpolation, but your model does not predict the data well in between the points. So if you look at this here, you interpolated all the points, but in between, it really fails, because the points are up here, but the actual model fits them to be down here. So we want a model that is good in predicting the general data. So you don't want it to be good only for the training data, right? In our calibration model here, you don't want to only undistort the points that are directly on the calibration model. You want to undistort the whole image. So it needs to be a good predictor for the whole image, not only for the training data. Overfitting can occur if you have a small amount of data only, and so if you have not enough training points. So this is another example that isn't drawn as bad as mine, So interpolation, again, hits every data point here. Regression is just the minimal distance to all the points and overfitting to the right. So this outside here is actually extrapolation. So you don't have a data point outside. You try to extrapolate the values outside your data set. It's also possible. Okay, what we can do is we can do bootstrapping. Bootstrapping is a word that is known from the Adventures of Baron Munchausen here. And it basically means that you can do a process that you would otherwise not be able to do. So you lift yourself up by your own bootstraps. And okay, this, you can read that at home. Okay. Let's just look at an example again. Okay, let's go back to our problem of a set of training points, and we want to fit a line. And we only have these 7 points. And what can I do now in order to estimate if our model that we fit is robust? What we can do in bootstrapping is we leave out one point, so I leave out this point, and I fit a line. Okay, so I get, let's go back to one. Okay, let's just look at a line that goes through the origin, so we don't have to deal with the t. Y is m times x, okay? This is the first measurement. We left out the first point. We got y is m0 times x. Now I can put this point back in, and I leave out the next point. And then I can estimate it again. And I get a different value for m. And then I can do it again for the third point, get a measurement, I can do it again and again and again. So I get n different equations. And so what can I do now? I can calculate the mean of all the estimations that I have. So I can get an m okay, this is the mean over all the estimated parameters m that I have. And basically that's most of the time a more reliable parameterization already. But I also can do calculate the variance over all the estimated parameters. So what is the variance? The variance tells us how the different m's, how much they vary from the mean. Okay, so the variance is defined as variance of the slope is 1 over n, sometimes it's 1 over n minus 1. And you calculate I. Okay, so this is the variance of the slope. So what if I have a high variance over my estimated parameters? It basically tells us that our model is not very robust to the data, because just by taking out one point, we can get a much different solution for our parameter. So basically, we want to get a model that has a very low variance, so it's very robust and reliable to estimate. Okay, we can also do that for multiple parameters, so the variance or the covariance matrix can be also defined by, so this is the covariance matrix, it's a large sigma. It can also be defined in vector notation. So we have the parameter vector x. Let's just call it x. And the mean over the parameters times OK, this is transposed in the end, if you can see it. So it's 1 over n times the parameter vector minus the mean parameter vector and multiplied by the parameter vector minus the mean parameter vector transposed. So you get a matrix that tells you the variances between the different parameter vectors. So on the diagonal of the matrix, you can get the variances for each parameter. Okay, another thing you can do with the bootstrapping is, it is similar to the one that we just did now. You can, again, do k different estimations. So you leave out one point. Then you do the mapping. So you fit a line. I leave out this point. I fit the line. And then I plug in the point that I left out. I plug it into the equation, into the mapping function here. And I map it with a function. And then I can compute the error of the map points to the function. So I can compute the error over all the left out points. And in the example of our distortion image, for example, I can leave out one calibration point. I can do a mapping. And then I use the mapping function for the one point that I left out. And then I end up somewhere on the distorted image. And I can just look how close the map point is to the actual point that I measured in my point correspondence set. So that's also sometimes called cross-validation, if you leave one point out, and then you validate your results with the estimated function. It's also common in pattern recognition. Okay, so another important thing you have to do is scaling of the input data. So scaling of the input data is something that is often overlooked by many people. And scaling is not really optional. It's actually considered mandatory. So data has to be normalized. And that is because we have to deal with a limited numerical accuracy. So we don't have unlimited numerical accuracy in computer systems. We have floats and doubles and integers. And so it can happen that we get rounding errors or stuff like that in the computation. So we have to try to minimize it by scaling the input data. And we can do that by minimizing the condition number. So the condition number you learned in the SVD chapter, it's the minimal singular value divided by the largest singular value. And you can use that to find a proper scaling for the data. So why do we need to scale the data? So if you look at this simple example, you chose to do a mapping function with a polynomial of degree 5. Okay, and you have the two images. You have the ideal image. It is a 1024 times 1024 image. And you have the distorted image, which is the same dimensions. And so each of the coordinates is represented in pixels, so they also range from 1 to 1024. Okay, so in your polynomial, the largest value that you can get is x or y to the power of 5. And if you plug in 1024 to the power of 5, you end up with this large number. But the function is actually mapping back to the range of 1 to 1024. So somehow we have to get from this large number back to one number that is between 0 and 1023. Okay, and that means that the coefficients have to be really small. So we can run into accuracy problems there. So they have to be, to get back from here to 0 and 1023, we have to have a very, very small coefficients. And that's not ideal. So you shouldn't have a good feeling in doing this. Okay. So this is the process to decide which scaling factor is the best. So the minimization of the condition number. So basically, you choose two constants, k and l, and you scale all your data points. So you just scale, you rewrite your matrix with k and l's in here. K, l. OK. You rewrite the matrix, and you compute the new A, your new measurement matrix. And then you can compute the condition number A transpose of A transpose times A. And if you look at all the different scaling factors, K and L, you can minimize it, for example, by gradient descent. And you will get some scaling factor for a minimum. You might not be able to find a global optimum. So any decrease of the condition number here is useful. So even if you can't find a global optimum, even a local optimum with maybe a larger scaling factor that is not ideal will improve your results. Yeah, and then you can just recover your original coefficients and invert the scaling. So I think a scaling factor that is ideal for many applications is, I think, the square root of 2 or 1 over the square root of 2. I'm not entirely sure right now. OK, so how do we get from the mapping function to our results? So how can we apply our mapping efficiently? The problem is, basically, for the undistortion process, we have to look at every pixel in the ideal image and apply the polynomial. And polynomial evaluation is not something that is easily computed, so it's slowing down the application quite a lot. So we have to look into how to speed up and efficiently evaluate the polynomials. So because we have to evaluate two polynomials for each pixel, one for the x and one for the y. And if you look at the bivariate function here, you can see that a bivariate polynomial is actually just a univariate polynomial where the coefficients are univariate polynomials. So if you just place these two parentheses, so this would be the coefficient of x. And you can just evaluate first the inner part, the sum over u times y prime to the power of y, j. And then you can do the evaluation for x. So that's already faster than evaluating the whole thing as it's written down here. And you also want to use the Horner scheme. The Horner scheme is the efficient way to evaluate the univariate polynomials because it has the least amount of mathematical operations. I think it reduces the parameters, the operations by half. So instead of just evaluating it like it's written down here, you can write it down as the Horner scheme, and you get a reduced amount of operations, and it's the fastest way. I think it's taught in Math 1 or something. Yeah, so Horner scheme, efficient way to evaluate the polynomials. And yeah, for each line, we get a univariate polynomial. So for each line in the image, the y is constant. So if we go through the image to undistort it, we can go through one pixel at a time, and the y doesn't change. So we don't have to, we can maybe save some computation time because the y is constant. What's also constant is the increments of the rows and columns. So as we've already discussed earlier, the distance between the pixels is always constant, so you always get the quadratic shape here for the Boolean interpolation. And also, the distance between here is the same as the distance between here. Also, it doesn't look like that in my drawing. and you can now use that in the arithmetic progression, so you can reuse former evaluations. You don't have to recompute the whole thing for each pixel. You can reuse your results from earlier evaluations. So yeah, the arithmetic progression is a sequence of numbers such that the difference of any two successive members of the sequence is a constant. So basically, you evaluate your polynomial P of x here, but then you want to also evaluate it here and here. So this is just, and this is x0, this is x0 plus h, because the increment is constant. This has to be x0 plus 2h, and so forth. So the increment is always h. And you can just use this equation here. And you just have to precompute the betas here for each line. And this is done with this algorithm. Yeah, what's important to know about this is that basically, the error sums up over the line, so you might have to recompute or reinitialize the beta values in the middle of the row. But yeah, the algorithm itself is not that important, I would say. So you don't have to learn it by heart, but you should know that it exists. Okay, interpolation. Yeah. Nearest neighbor interpolation. Take the nearest pixel and assign the intensity. And Boolean interpolation is just the weighted average of the neighboring intensities. So again, here's the drawing. So for the nearest neighbor, the pixel A is the closest, so you assign this intensity value to it. And for the Boolean interpolation, it's basically the same equations that we did earlier, just with different values for the distances. So again, if you plug this, the x and the y, into the third equation, you will see that the weights are just the area of the rectangles that are spanned by the point that you want to interpolate and the neighboring points. Okay, so let's summarize the distortion algorithm. How can we apply the distortion correction now? You go through the image, you go over all x and y pixels, and then you compute. This was the ideal image, okay? So you go over each pixel. For each pixel, you compute your mapping for x, you compute your mapping for y, and then you map it into the distorted image. So the distorted image is the G here. And then you do an interpolation to get your intensity value, because you don't exactly hit a pixel. So you interpolate your value at this point. And then you plug the intensity into this pixel here. And you go to the next pixel, map the pixel, interpolate the intensity, and plug it in. So you're sampling the output space here, the ideal image, because you're iterating over the coordinates of the output space. Okay, you can also accelerate the whole thing using hardware. And yeah, what's typically done in hardware is you subdivide the problem into smaller parts, so you decompose it into smaller squares, and then you can do the whole thing on the texture mapping unit on the hardware. So you just have to calibrate your model, and then you can do the correction on the GPU directly. And on the GPU, you don't have to think about bilinear interpolation, because it's implemented in the graphics card already. It's just a texture lookup. And yeah, the mapping itself is also hardware supported, so it's very fast. So that's important, because we need real-time undistortion for the 3 frames per second. Okay, so one other application where we can use image undistortion is endoscopy. So if you look at the left image here, you can see again that the tool in the top left corner is a bit curved. So you know there's a distortion effect that's caused by the small lenses in the endoscope. It causes this distortion effect here. And you can do the same thing. You use a calibration model, and you can you take a picture from the endoscope, and you can calibrate your mapping function. And you end up with a calibrated image here, where the surgic tool is straight again. OK, so the take-home messages. X-ray imaging can cause different artifacts. So different detector technologies will result in different artifacts. So we don't have this distortion problem with flat panel detectors. Instead, we will have other problems. I think defect pixel interpolation is the next topic in the lecture. So in flat panels, you can end up with pixels that are just black because you can't manufacture it perfectly. Yeah, image intensifiers, however, result in distorted images. And if we want to use the images for reconstruction, for example, we have to undistort them. And yeah, now you should be familiar with the core concepts of calibration. So you place a calibration model onto your detector. You take a picture. And you can use the point correspondences from that in order to estimate a mapping function. And you can do that with least squares estimators. You also learned about efficient evaluations of polynomials, so Horner scheme, and arithmetic progression, where you can reuse earlier results. And yeah, data normalization is mandatory. So again, because of the high degrees of polynomials, you will end up with high numbers, and you will get numerical inaccuracies. So you have to scale your data. Finally, bilinear interpolation is sufficient for nearly all practical problems, and it's always integrated in hardware, so you can just use your GPU. So these are some books you can look at. So Art of Computer Programming, if you're interested in evaluation of polynomials, or if you want to get a deeper insight into X-ray systems, you can look at this Bildgebende Systeme für die Diagnostik. Okay. Before you all leave, there's no lecture on Thursday, and there's also no exercise on Wednesday. The Wednesday exercise will start next week, because the Martinstrasse 3 is still blocked by construction work. So you won't miss anything, so don't go to the Thursday exercise. Just come next week. We will cover the MATLAB introduction and the first exercise in this first exercise then.